types and groups. And so we just mapped out at the base level the word for caribou in many different languages and dialects of British Columbia and Alberta and into the U.S. And you can see some interesting patterns and language families there, and you can see just the tip of the iceberg of the diversity of knowledge that exists for caribou.
There's a couple things I want to pull apart there, but just right off the get-go, you said there are some interesting trends or takeaways from that data. Can you give me a couple examples?
Yeah, so I think you see pretty immediately that there's a lot of diversity within languages. So individual communities will have different ways of spelling words and different dialects and slightly different pronunciations, which from talking with elders is something that can be overlooked or has often been overlooked by biologists in the past, where in biology and in Western approaches to science, we often want to bring together things and just like, this is the most simple thing. We'll just say one, like all of these speakers probably would say wudzi for caribou, but that's not true. And it kind of erases a lot of small but very important information that exists, that there's mudzi and woodzi and wadzi and many different ways to say that. And so Indigenous communities often don't want to be defined as like a pan-Indigenous understanding of people, and they want their diversity to be showcased. And so I think when you look at a map that shows all the words that we can collect right now and verify with communities, it helps people see, oh, wow, there's a lot out there. There's a lot of communities. There's a lot of languages. So that's really interesting. The other part is, which I'm open to more help and to people jumping in for more analysis of this, but I think there are some interesting linguistic patterns that arise. And I'm not a linguist, but I get to work with amazing language speakers and linguists, academic linguists sometimes. And I think you can look at how languages moved and traveled over time, how people shared words, how trade networks existed, how important words for a species that people depended on are related to other important words or tools or hunting techniques or even concepts that people have about the world. And you can start to tie those in linguistically with the endings of words and what that means. And then you could do comparisons to look at ecological connections. So why maybe in Cree is the word for caribou related to other ungulates like elk and moose, but in other languages, caribou is its own word, not related to other ungulates. And what could that teach us about the history of people's identity and relationship with these species and other species?
Yeah, you talked a lot in the conversation about the value of Indigenous names for caribou and other related words, because the language is a way to describe the environment and arises out of this need to describe the environment that you live in. So it contains all this extra information. You also just mentioned how there's this tendency in standard Western science to simplify in a way, or to be like, well, this is the basic word for caribou, and you're erasing all this information there. And it seems like, from an outsider, that when you're doing research and science-related things, the more data, the better, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that the sort of thrust of traditional Western biology, I guess, for some time anyway, was not interested in that.
Yeah, so there's this idea of a reductionist approach to science, which comes from some Western traditions of scientific inquiry, where the reductionist approach is trying to think, there is so much data in the world, there's so much information, but say physics, which through a reductionist approach, you can get to like laws that then hold meaning across huge swaths of many other sciences as well. And ecology has always sort of broken that mold, because ecology is so inherently complex. And sometimes you can put together two pieces of a puzzle, like an ecological system, and the outcome is something you couldn't have predicted. And those kind of ideas make ecology something that I think doesn't actually fit with a reductionist approach very easily. And many other ecologists have for generations, even from the Western scientific traditions, also explored that, like where the complexity of an ecosystem is through its diversity of small pieces that all need to be examined and understood. And so in that way, that also comes from teachings I've been lucky enough to have from elders, specifically when I worked in the Northwest Territories in the Satu, elders talking about how you need to understand how ticks are affecting the species and what ptarmigan are doing if you want to understand what the caribou are going to do this year, and not losing the small pieces. And I think ecology often talks about that. Like, we need to understand all these small components of an ecosystem, how the water is flowing, how rain is affecting things, how the green up this year affects the herbivores and the insects and the small birds and the spiders, and how all that web of understanding, the web of the food web, then affects what the system is doing as a whole. So ecology is kind of well equipped to take on a multifaceted understanding. And I think one thing it has missed is that multifaceted understanding also including other cultural views. Mm-hmm. And those cultural views are informed by their language. Like I talked about yesterday, and you said, like, the language comes from people's relationship with where they came from. Their language literally evolved in coevolution with caribou, coevolution with the glacial retreat, and coevolution with the boreal forest. And when you have that, it's just a different system, and it has minutiae of information about, like, all the names for beaver, for example, like a young beaver, a baby beaver, a teenager beaver, a beaver that just left its family, a male and a female, a young male and a female. There's like 15 names in Dene just for beaver. Mm-hmm. And in Western societies, in English, which is the only language I speak, we have the same thing for, like, sheep and cows and goats and pigs and chickens, where hen, rooster, chick, and we have all the names for the different age groups, like for all the cows and all the horses. So we have that for animals that were really important to us, people whose ancestry is Europe. And then here in North America, there's not just one, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of languages that then have that kind of key information held within them. And it's hard to envision, but if you sit with people who speak that language, I think you can start to get an idea of, wow, if your lens is through that, you must see the world differently. And that could bring really, really valuable insight to ecology and to the work that we're doing for, like, recovery planning for caribou.
I think it's really easy to conceptualize of, like, traditional, in this case, indigenous knowledge and scientific knowledge as sort of oppositional or as different from each other. But I think if you look at it, there is a lot of overlap, and there is a lot in the Dene way of understanding their environment that, if you look at it again through that sort of scientific ecological lens that is looking at all the little components and how everything is intersecting and overlapping.
Yeah, and, like, just like everything, if we come into conversation with curiosity, we often discover that we're not in opposition. We just had a different starting viewpoint, or we're considering the question slightly differently, right? And so once in a while, there will be, like, big conflicts between an indigenous perspective of a caribou population and a Western scientific understanding of a caribou population. And because of a history of trauma and colonization and forced removals from land management and decision-making that indigenous communities have faced, and racism, those conversations often start pretty on touchy ground and difficult situations. But if we can come with curiosity, I think it's often not unresolvable misinformation or complete lack of understanding. Like, if you can listen to an elder explain why a ptarmigan is important to caribou, like, they're going to make a rational story that does make sense and helps us understand a perspective that's different than what we were taught through school, for example, or through an undergrad education. Yeah.
With all science, a big challenge is communication, translating your work into language that can help or that can be understood by whoever the work is most relevant to, right? And in your case, obviously, caribou are very central and important to a lot of the indigenous people, particularly indigenous people who have specific names and words for caribou. I just wonder about the work you're doing is both incorporating that language, but part of it is also making it accessible for the people who this research is most important for. And I just wonder if that's something that enters your mind as a thought, or if that just sort of happens as a result of the work that you're doing.
No, I think we have to be very careful and considerate of that question. Yeah, like everyone needs to work on language communication and how we can do this better. And I wouldn't say any of us would have the assumption that we're doing it perfectly to make this, one, accessible to the general public who might read a recovery strategy, accessible to proponents who are trying to make land use decisions in certain regions, or to Indigenous communities who use these recovery strategies for their own land use planning and decision making for wildlife management as they work within their own communities and within their own First Nations bands. Organizations. So yeah, you have to be careful about it. One way to help with that I also focus on is through art, or just what I mean by art can hold lots of meaning, but how can you graphically represent some of these complex ideas through illustration, through diagrams, through graphic recordings, to help make things pop off the page and be a little more relevant. And that can also help with people feeling seen a little bit more when they see their words translated into an image, or their words just captured in like short fragments in graphic recording as well. And so we are also trying in this recovery strategy not to just include language and tables of language words for caribou and maps, but also a first attempt, and I know this can be done better, and hopefully people will help us with guidance on that too, but with including imagery that helps people see through some of the complexity a little bit and also be seen a little bit better.
Great. And just really broadly, what do you hope this work accomplishes?
One of the hopes would be that when a community member opens this, it's a much better representation of their views and understanding of the world than we had in 2014. But again, it's not going to be the end-all be-all of that. And I hope that through this work, it also encourages communities to say, hey, this recovery strategy that's the federal document is not quite going to do the job at reflecting my worldview because it's constrained by a structural process that the bureaucracy demands. And so we're going to do our own thing, and it's going to help caribou in this way. And so there could be offshoots and parallel documents that are developed by communities, and we're hoping to support those with funding. And then, yeah, I hope that the document also does a better job at informing the general public that caribou are really important to communities, and that communities' voices should be centered in these documents. And I know it would be just a bridge in a longer process of reconciliation that's going on to start this work. Like, this is maybe some things that can start happening in more recovery strategies and more federal documents and more provincial documents about caribou, where it'll become more standard practice just to include the words for caribou, for example, in all the languages of people who are interested in it. Or there might be, and my bigger hope would be that we can start reclaiming Indigenous names for caribou in like formal species names, subspecies names, and herd names.
Dr. Jean Polfus is a senior species at risk biologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service, Pacific Region Division of Environment and Climate Change Canada. She is working to update the recovery strategy for woodland caribou, southern mountain population, to incorporate the language, knowledge, and perspectives of Indigenous populations with long-standing relationships to caribou. You can find out more about her work at yourcrier.org. That's yourcrier.org. I'm Jesse Wenslaw for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. Herons come in an assortment of sizes. The largest in the U.S., the great blue heron, stands 4.5 feet tall. The smallest by far is the least bittern, at just 10 to 12 inches tall. You'll often find a least bittern straddling the stems of tall reeds in a marsh. Grasping a cluster of stems in the long toes of each foot, they suspend themselves over the edge of the marsh, a foot or more above the water. Watching for prey, bitterns lean forward while pulling their long necks back, like drawing a bowstring. Their needle-like bills dart out when they spot a fish. During the nesting season, least bitterns bend clusters of reeds into platforms to perch on and hunt from, Like any good angler, if they have luck fishing in one spot, they'll keep reusing it. Vulnerable to birds of prey, least bitterns rely on their camouflage of rust, buff, and dark green plumage. Stretching their necks upward, parallel to the upright reeds, they sway slowly, imitating the reeds moving in the breeze. Least bitterns are experts at staying hidden, which makes encountering one even more exciting. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
All right, sorry about that, folks. I cut off the started Bird Note a little early there and cut off the credits for our last feature interview. That was by Jesse Wentzloff, right from here at CJSF and supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, which is a program of the federal government and funded through sort of Canadian Talent Development, a bunch of different sources of funding, but is a great program supporting two journalists here at CJSF, making it possible to cover our local communities so much better. And we're really excited about this program and its future with us. So you're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up in about 14 minutes is Democracy Now! Up at noon is Wandering Rhythms with Nick Legacy, and lots more great programming here on CJSF today and into this evening. Peter R.H.
Yes, so anyway.
The Warriors.
Well, last Monday, Candleland, on this station, because we have it from 5 to 6 today, p.m., that is, they got something, a podcast from the New Yorker magazine.
Yeah.
It's a podcast. So they got the person who did Hamilton, which is a Broadway show based on a president of the United States.
Yeah.
And then he just said, we don't know whether it can be a play or not, but we made like a long playing record, or I guess a compact, that's what he would call it. We did a musicality of the 1979 film The Warriors.
Right.
And what kind of incensed me, I finally saw it on Sunday.
So let's do a very quick synopsis of the plot. Sentences.
It's that there's this big congregation of gangs, all the New York gangs. It's massive.
Right.
And the guy said, let's all collaborate. And let's have peace among us so we can be the people who take over New York City. And then he gets assassinated, and they blame one gang, which didn't do it, the Warriors.
Yeah.
And the Warriors have to travel from wherever they are over to Coney Island, which is their turf as such.
So they have to... they have to travel through enemy territory, so to speak, to get back to their safe, home base.
What incensed me, and I heard it from beginning to end, the podcast again after hearing in the middle when it was broadcast here on CJSF, was their superficiality about how they were analyzing that what this film, because there were, and I'm going to quote from Wikipedia here. The film was linked to sporadic outbreaks of vandalism and three killings, two in Southern California and one in Boston, involving moviegoers on their way to and from showings. And then going back here, I think this is somebody talking about the film. I think the reason why there were some violent incidents, this is really very simple. The film was very popular with the street gangs, especially young people, a lot of whom had very strong feelings about each other, and suddenly they all went to the movie together. They looked across the aisle, and they were the guys they didn't like. So there were a lot of incidences. Okay, and so this thing, which you can still hear on their podcast or the New Yorker podcast, it's very superficial. They say they made so many great fashion statements in the movie, and I mean. And I'm kind of incensed by that. And This film is part of the culture of violence, or sort of. I mean, there's something about some New Yorkers. We're talking like 40 years ago. They become proud of their culture of violence. They come, we can take it. You know, they make a look at that graffiti, which is tagging. A lot of it is just tagging.
Yeah.
Which, is, in fact, they have it in the film example, and it goes, I better tag this little thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we see in the Lower Mainland, too, is not anything artistic. It's just a gang or whatever.
Or just someone wants to leave their mark. But yeah, tagging.
It's right. Just,
I mean, they create a sort of logo for themselves, and then they put it everywhere.
So it's not an artistic thing.
No.
Now, what was interesting was that. Let's see here. Okay, what it was that when I was looking at a variety of information about the film, there was a group which came back because they felt they ought to come back. It's called the Guardian Angels.
Right.
The New York Guardian Angels. And they protest the film in early 1979.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was interesting. I get stationed in the United States on my little white plastic thing. I used to call them rabbit ears. I had, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, CPAC from the United States, and they had a documentary about the Guardian Angels. And I was sort of always down on them because they wanted to have a Vancouver chapter in the 1980s. I thought that was kind of dumb. What it was, when I saw this documentary, which I re-saw just the past week, was that I said, that's interesting. Okay, this is why it was created. Now...
part of the context for the, in the 1970s was sort of the late 60s and the 1970s and into the 80s perhaps even, well, I think 90s even, was sort of that era of rising crime and, rising violent crime, which for a long time was sort of, it was something people were concerned about.
Right.
Crime rates went up and, there's a lot of, and it was at the same time you saw a certain amount of hollowing out of American cities, which was for a different reason, because that was sort of the exodus to the suburbs, which left, a lot of major American centers somewhat struggling.
If I can incidentally...
And lots of gang activity, lots of crime activity, which eventually abated in the 90s. But that's just the background.
No, I want to bring up something... It's called the Madonna theory of basically urbanization,
mm-hmm.
that your city becomes a big donut, and the very former center becomes like a wasteland melodramatic, but it's not where most people want to be, or you have you're up at your head office or whatever. Mm-hmm. So your urbanality becomes a donut.
Yeah,
and.
I didn't want to drag you away from your point. I just wanted to give that bit of background because
I'm going to not give an entirely uncritical response to it because I'm going to bring up something later on. But what happened was this, his name is Curtis...
Curtis Sliwa.
Sliwa, that's right.
Yep. He was the leader of the Guardian Angels.
Yeah, and it's very much... a leadership thing. Everybody seems to be as flunky, which is being a bit critical. That's just the way it seems to be, right? But he was a manager at a McDonald's.
Okay.
And it kind of comes holistically from there because he dealt with all the problems. The police not doing anything. The police are wanting free food instead of dealing with the problems that were going on.
Yeah.
And... the Guardian Angels sort of evolved from there, which are patrolling the subway system. The other thing is that I think Vancouver, we have the infamous downtown east side. But in New York, you have the subway system. Very much the crime got very much involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things they did, and they're doing again, is the patrol of the subways.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to come with something that's not so good. They actually faked a few things, because in Curtis, okay, you said the, how did I say the last name?
Curtis Sliwa.
Sliwa. He, there was in 1992, some mafia guy gave him a good shot in the ribs, meaning to kill him. And so, which actually happened, but then Curtis decided to come clean about a few things, how they kind of faked a few things in the 1980s. Oh, my goodness.
What sort of things? Like incidents where the guardian angel stepped in and saved the day or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I wanted to get the exact thing here. Okay, in 1992, Curtis admitted that he and the guardian angels faked heroic subway rescues for the publicity. He also admitted to having claimed falsely that three off-duty transit officials had kidnapped him. Actually, the thing that initially happened was that they got a Roman Catholic priest to go along with this, that they had found his wallet for $300.
Mm.
And that, he said, if we hadn't done that, we may couldn't have started our little group. But that was a faked thing. Now, here's some here. It was a lot of, like, Mayor Ed Koch, supposedly, in the first month, was for them, and then he came out against them.
Right.
In 1981, then, Mayor Ed Koch, a critic of Curtis and his the organization, launched an investigation into the Guardian Angels, which, according to the Washington Post, proved so positive that the Guardian Angels will soon be awarded some sort of official status. Mayor Ed Koch kind of reversed it, because a lot of people in New York kind of appreciated them. Oh, one thing I'm going to say, which was interesting, the outfit they had, like, there wasn't like a security guard outfit. I was a security guard a long time ago. And that sort of means, oh, I can call the police. They did sort of a thing which is sort of a bit creative. In a sense, it's the T-shirt and that jacket, sort of a bit, and the red beret, which sort of,
mm-hmm.
I guess, has a connotation of the green berets of the Vietnam thing, which is not good, I guess. But it's sort of more, I think the outfit was actually good, because it sort of indicated we're here to help, but we're not being a security guard or a police officer.
Well, in many ways, they sort of styled themselves as kind of like a gang for good.
Yeah.
Right? Because, I mean, they wore sort of like, almost like a gang colors, because they had like I can't remember exactly what it was. They had the red beret, like a burgundy beret, and like a vest with a big patch on the back that said Guardian Angels, right?
Which is the old seeing eye. They kind of had a streamlined thing of that, which I talked about a year ago.
Yeah.
Where that came from.
So, I mean, you know, and they sort of dressed and looked a bit like they were a gang. They were just the gang that was...
Yeah.
You know, not engaged in criminal activity, but they were, you know, the good guys.
But they sort of did, as I say, they did, I guess Curtis wanted people to know, hey, I was kind of hit, so I got to become clean about what I wasn't so honest right. about. But so
we got a minute left here.
Yes.
So you watched the film.
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
What did you think of the film?
I thought it was sort of... the problem is that what sort of brought up about what was happening in the 1980s, what I don't like about the Warriors is that it puts them in a positive light in a way.
Right.
It doesn't... Like, they don't bring up, hey, sometimes gangs just sort of beat people up just because they feel like it. They just don't... They're not heroic things.
Heroic, yeah.
It's sort of implied in the film that they're beating each other up, and then the police are beating them up.
Right.
But supposedly what happened was the police weren't even doing anything about the gangs in reality. But anyway, so no, I give a rating of zero for Candleland for doing this and the New York podcast.
That's it for today. Thank you. Democracy Up! Is up now.